Welcome to Red Inca. I'm Jared Kimber. This episode of Red Inca is with Brian Charles Lara, mostly because of the release of his new book, Lara, The England Chronicle. We talk about his relationship with England, field placements, backlifts, Warner Murley, batting in weaker sides, breaking world records, and plump pots. Hey, mate, thanks for doing this.
Not a problem.
First question is, why this book?
Why this book or why this time?
Well, both, I suppose. You know, I'm interested in why you suddenly wanted to tell this story now.
Story now, and obviously the fractions in terms of wanting to tell a story against England only. Well, how I look at it is that my first book was done very prematurely. Obviously, a couple of world records. I think we were roughly around 1994, 95. And it's, you know, it didn't really cover my entire career. I've been a little bit turned off of books when you have five or six people doing their own research and you know, getting their unauthorized biography out. So I really just sort of just shelved the idea. Also, finishing my cricket in 2007. I was very enthusiastic about leaving the game and finding happiness somewhere else, because I spent all my life playing cricket from the time I was a little boy until I became a professional. And I always felt that my story will be relevant no matter what period. So I didn't have a problem taking this long. To be honest, there is in my hand, my Australian version of this book, that was even before COVID. And I've sat on it for a while because, again, you know, the story I want to tell is not, it's more, I want to tell the right story, the factual story, the truth, and to understand myself some more when I'm writing out. So we've done this book, and I felt that doing a book on England might have been the right start because of the relationship that both England and the West Indies share on a cricket field, socially, politically, and what England meant to me as a young man growing up, or playing against England meant to me as a young man growing up, is very significant.
It's interesting when you look back at it, your two world records, well, your three world records, two of them are against England, one's in county cricket. Is there something about England that motivates you in a different way? Is there something about England bowlers that was different than South African bowlers or Australian bowlers or Indian bowlers? Like, what do you think it was that got you to those heights against, you know, in those three occasions?
I mean, you've got to be there. When an England team arrives in the Caribbean, there's a different buzz to any other country in the world. I mean, of course, close proximity in terms of a test playing nation, and as I spoke to you about the history between the West Indies and England. Now, in 1950 or in the 40s, the West Indies was not playing against India. We weren't playing against New Zealand. We were playing against England. Might have had a series or two against Australia. So that history goes a long way back. And every time my father or any of the elders talk about cricket, it would be about, you know, West Indies cricket or 1950s success, and the fact that a lot of the islands, the feeling is a lot of the islands gained independence because of our prowess on the cricket field. So a series between West Indies and England meant the world to me. And at the time, I don't know if today, but at the time, England is, you know, has been the epicenter for cricket for a very, very long time.
You were at your absolute best when you were motivated, you know, whether it be a sledge or a match incident or everything else. You know, I'm writing this book about the best 50 batters of all time. Everyone has you right at the top of their list, right? If not number one, obviously in the top five or top 10 that they've ever seen. And what the one thing they say is that you didn't have the consistency of Tendulkar or Callis, but when you wanted to be at that player, you went above that sort of level. So what was it that suddenly switched it for you? Could it be a comment? Could it be a game? Could it be, as you said, the historical importance? It felt like you needed just that little bit more motivation than perhaps some of the other batters who just got up and wanted to score runs every day.
I think I think also, you know, there was a price in my head very early in my career. I mean, most of the stuff I did was before I got to 20 test matches. And, you know, being the center of attention, I think a lot of batters would not have carried that burden. So also, you know, you're playing with a team where you're generally, you're the main batter. And, you know, the success of the team sometimes depended a lot on your performance. That added a lot of pressure. So sometimes it may seem that I was not motivated, but I also didn't think that I had the greatest technique as well. I think that was something that I always had to work on. I was an aggressive player. Sometimes, you know, people talk about my back lift. I found more problems with, you know, sometimes moving across my stump too much. And all these things play. So I would never place myself as being the perfect batter. I was definitely not Dravid. I was definitely not Kallis. And certainly not Tendulkar. But when I got into my zone and when I felt that I was, you know, winning the battle mentally, that was when I was at my best. And to everyone or to you, it may seem like if something spurred him on, something motivated him. But it is just, I think it's just a theater. I think it's a theater. Yes, on many occasions, a bowler or a captain or a fielder may say something to me that I wasn't going to back down. And the best way for me to speak. So yes, I'm a little bit guilty of that in a good way, that sometimes that brought out the best in me. But, you know, I have no problem falling, you know, behind the line when it comes to this technical prowess of a Tendulkar or Kallis. I'm fine with that.
It's funny. You said about 20 interesting things there, but let's just go to the technical one because you finished with that. Did people try and change your backlift is my question, because it's so extravagant, right? And it's so different to a lot of other players. Did you have coaches as you were coming up going, that's not going to work for you?
No, none at all. I was lucky that way that, you know, you see the present day golfer, they would win a major or two, and then they'd change their swing by the end of the year. I think with my cricket and with the success that I was having as a young man through school age group cricket, I felt that everybody was just more in awe and you know, happy that I was, you know, playing the way that I was playing. I think the West Indies have a certain flair about it, and I don't think anybody interfered with Sir Vivian Richards. I don't think anybody interfered with Gus Logie. All these guys have different, you know, little character traits with their batting, and it was the same with me.
And the other thing that you mentioned was you became the focal point of that batting lineup. The further your career goes, the sort of, obviously, Shivnarine Chandrapal comes up, but it really is yourself, Shivnarine Chandrapal, and probably Sarwan almost holding the batting up for a long period of time. When you came into the side, it was a lot stronger and there was a lot more batters that were very talented. Does that affect you? Or is each individual ball, each of individual innings different? Or are you thinking a little bit more towards the middle and later part of your career? I've got to bat in a certain way because we might not be as strong as we used to be.
Well, first of all, Viv said it first. Where sitting to bat is very, you know, I get very anxious, antsy, I want to go to the bathroom. So I had this mental picture of always going out to bat as quickly as possible. That was the first picture that I had in my mind. And so I embrace pressure. My best scores have come under pressure, and my best scores have come when the West Indies maybe two or three down. We don't have 50 runs on the board as yet. And that is definitely made me sort of buckle in and score big. So I've never really been affected by it. You know, one of the things that I would, you know, sort of would have loved to change, or if I had a second go at it, is sometimes, you know, you put the team is in a great position, but come the fourth and fifth day, there's only one winner and it's the opposition. And I found myself very difficult and struggling with that sort of pressure. So I maybe, you know, and it's evident, I don't have to hide from it. You know, my first innings, average is much better than my second innings average. I played majority of the time in a team that was either trying to stop off defeat or was defeated. We didn't win much test matches back then. So it meant that a lot of my second innings was played under tremendous pressure. And if I had to do it again, I think I would have a different approach.
I want to talk about spin a little bit. You know, there's yourself and Andy Flower, a couple of other players from the same era who were brilliant at playing spin, but come from outside of Asia. But you still have the background of lots of spin being bowled in Trinidad, the wickets turning quite a bit. How much of it is a natural part of your game? And how much do you think it was being in the right place at the right time and the conditions helping out?
I don't understand being in the right place at the right time. I don't know if you want to explain that, but it was just...
Well, if you'd grown up in Jamaica, where Sabina Park is more about facing pace, would you be better at facing pace? And whereas Trinidad at that era, you know, with those wickets, does that help you? I suppose is what I'm saying.
Yeah. I mean, the answer to that is also the population. You know, if you go back into time, you know that Guyana and Trinidad was where a lot of the indentured laborers from India came from, and Guyana and Trinidad, again, the soil content is not, you know, the coral or the bauxite that you have in Jamaica, the coral in Barbados. It's more marshland where, you know, the pitches were a lot, didn't have that soundness, didn't have that firmness, that concrete feel, as you see in Jamaica and other places. So those were two major factors. We created a lot more spinners in Guyana and Trinidad compared to the other islands. And, you know, from street cricket to, you know, playing on a dust bowl in the savannah in my village, you know, I learned to play spin much quicker than fast bowling.
So you felt that even when you were a kid, you felt that was the thing that you were developing a little bit earlier, was the ability to play spin quicker.
Yeah, most definitely. I went to India when I was 14 with a schoolboys team and got a proper amount of spin, you know, as a young man, and I handled it pretty well in India.
So your record against Warner Murali, I think you average over 70 direct head-to-head against both of those bowlers. They're very different. Obviously, one spins it away, one spins it back in. Is there anything that you had to change in the way that you played spin? Because you can grow up in Trinidad and play all the guys from Guyana and you can go to India. But Warner Murali were very different, of course, different kinds of spinners than you probably would have faced back when you were growing up.
Yeah, but the similarity with them is the fact that they gave the bowler a little bit of air. And I was someone who loved to use my feet, get down the wicket, didn't like to be trapped in my crease with spinners. So, you know, the Sakhalin and the Harbhajan Singh and maybe even Kumble with the low trajectory and getting the ball through as quick as possible had me a little bit more tied down than say a Murali and a Shane. They were of course outstanding spinners and maybe the best spinners, but with my ability to pick up from the fingers what the ball is trying to do, I mean, that's the first thing I will tell any youngster. You know, I think with T20, because there's this drive to smash everything, that they're forgetting to look and see what the bowler is delivering out of his fingers. And I think that was one of my strength, to know if it was a googly, to know if it was a flipper from Shane or if it was a Dusra from Murali. I picked those things up pretty quickly from the fingers. Of course, I had a second line of decision-making when the ball was coming down in the air to see if it spin, which direction it's spinning. Mm.
Cricket 8 brings you this show. They are analysing every part of our game. Head over for their watch-alongs, podcasts, and articles on what is really happening on the field and why it matters. Cricket8.com is your place for cricket intelligence. I want to get back to the England part of this. Obviously, that's the major part of your book and everything. There's an innings I watched recently. I was talking to Jimmy Adams, and he told me to find this innings. I can't remember now if it was at Old Trafford or if it was Trent Bridge. I think it's Trent Bridge, where you hit boundaries from force slip to extra cover. And there's like a boundary every 5 meters when you look at the wagon wheel. You went all the way through. And Mike Atherton, I think, was the captain. He kept putting fielders in and you kept picking the gaps. Your ability to pick gaps, again, is that something that is natural to you? Is that something that is that you had to learn when you got to that level?
No, that was natural. I played a lot of cricket in my garage by myself, and I would set up plan putts and you know, I'd have my scoring, my copybook to score. And these plan putts represented fielders. So I'd maybe throw the ball against the wall and I would hit the gaps, massive plan putts. You know, it wasn't easy to hit. The minute you hit the plan putt, it's not runs. And I think I developed that desire to get value for my shots every time that I played. So for me, I had this mental picture of where everybody, when I walked out to bat, I knew where everybody was. If I wanted to get single, to get off the mark, if I wanted to take advantage of a bowler and score boundaries, I knew where every single player was. And you sort of play that game of chess where you got the captain moving players into certain positions to create other gaps for you. So when I was in full flow, you know, you would hardly see me hit a ball to, you know, a bad ball to straight to a fielder. I most likely will delay my shot or hit it early, open the face, close the face, all depending on where I can find a gap.
And how, when at that particular innings or those innings when you're playing in England where they just, you just kept punishing them through the offside, is it also then part of the game that you're literally saying you could put three fielders? I think at one stage you had two gullies, a point and a cover point, and you're still picking the gaps between them. Is that your way of using that skill to further dominate, to say to the bowler and the captain, there's nothing you can do here?
Well, not in an arrogant way, but
of course.
No, but in a, I mean, at the end of the day, when you have a captain changing a field or you have a bowler, you would look into their eyes and you would see if they're defeated or not. You would see that they, you know, grabbing a straw or whatever the case may be. That innings in Nottingham, I was bowled to a leg side field where I eventually got out caught off my glove, I think, down the leg side, if that was the right match.
Yep.
And so that's the extreme that you know, a captain will have to go to limit your scoring opportunities. But I would look at my game was based more on the mental side of it than the practical side of it. You know, I didn't mind how bad I look, but as soon as I come out of that survival mode, as soon as I come out of that period where I feel 30% belong to me, 70% belong to the bowlers, and it starts shifting into my direction, is when I start taking in charge of the game. But more than anything else, mentally, I can look at the bowler and I know that he doesn't want to bowl at me. I can look at a captain, I can see that he wants to go on the defensive, but he's a bit puzzled, or he's quite happy to bowl at the the non-strikers. And these are the battles that I wanted to win, and these are the battles that were the minute I knew I won it, I took charge of the innings.
And the last innings, of course, is when you regain the world record. So again, it's against England, and as you've already said, there's a history there. You want to dominate them. But was there a part of you felt like you owned that record and it was part of your identity, and when it was ripped away, if you had another chance to get it, you were going to go for it? Was that any part of your thinking? Was it just, again, the day came, the bowlers were bowling, poor Gareth Batty had to go?
Yeah, so it was October, October, November, when my lawyer called me, English lawyer. He said he has a number for me to call, and that was Matthew Hayden, your record was just broken. I was about 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. I was in Jamaica, playing maybe first class cricket, and I called Matthew, but immediately, obviously there is a little bit of shock and sadness might be the word, but oh, you've lost your record. But that's fine, because at the time I was captain in the West Indies for the second time, and it was 2003 that I assumed that captaincy again, and my focus then was on becoming a better captain and trying to see if I can bring a team together moving forward. I always felt that those two records sometimes were a burden in terms of, you know, it brought a lot of great stuff to me, but it also brought a lot of attention and scrutiny and negativity. So I had no problem. Now, with 100 runs in six test innings leading into Antigua, no one can tell me that I was thinking about a record. I was thinking of getting off the mark, you know, and I was thinking of getting West Indies. I mean, because there was some hesitance because we were batting so badly, there was some hesitance winning the toss and deciding what we should do, because the best way to draw a test match is let the opposition do what they have. And then you know what you have to do to save the follow-on. You know what you have to do to drag this game out. If you bat first and you get out cheaply, then the test match is, you know, most likely over. So there was some hesitance, but we realized that this pitch is as good as ever, and we cannot allow England the opportunity to bat first. And I got in. I think Michael Vaughan still talks about the fact that he thinks I was out or not, caught behind off Hamerson. I said to him, I don't walk because you think I am out. I walk when I know I'm out. And what happened during the match is that, you know, I got set, and I can tell, again, that mental victory. England kept me down and out for six innings. But I can tell when I start to get going and I start getting 50, 60, and I got to 100, I can see like, okay, you know, they accept that this is going to be a big one, or this is going to be something different. This is not what happened in the last six test match. And you know, winning that mental side of it made things much easier for me.
And then from then on in, there's obviously something within your personality that allows for those massive innings, right? That drives you once you're in that inning. So, you know, I talked to Mark Waugh, and Mark Waugh said to me, oh, I'd make 100 and then I'd done my job and off I was. There's something about Brian Lara that obviously went, no, I'm going to keep going as far as I can now.
Well, that's Mark Waugh. But if you speak to maybe Sangakkara, who's got 9 test hundreds, you know, Sobers or even, you know, the guys who've gone on to score, you know, quite a few double hundreds, that the enjoyment just starts. And when I say enjoyment, is maybe the lack of enjoyment from the bowling side of it. You know, they are tired, they are defeated. And okay, Mark Waugh might say, time to go back in, so let me give somebody my wicket. I would say it's not time to go back in. Let me take advantage of this situation, because, you know, I learned very early in my career, you know, you move your average from 30 to 50 with one innings, 277, you know, and, you know, if you start to, you know, give away your innings, then, you know, what's going to happen? You have to take advantage of the times that are going good for you, because the bad times are definitely going to come.
Beautiful. Thank you very much for having a chat, mate. You have a great day.
Same to you. Thank you.
Cheers, mate. Bye.
Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Baron Kazi and Estelle Vassadevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make a lot of content like me, oh, you are going to need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up incredible clips from your podcasts and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.